Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
So, Steve, did Ava Gardner and Howard Hughes have a good relationship?
Well, they did, until he dislocated her jaw.
What?
Well, don't worry. She hit him back with an ashtray.
From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
Hello, my name is Matt, host of the Pirate History Podcast. Pirates rank among the most mythologized and romanticized of all historical figures. It can become easy to forget that pirates were real people that had real-world concerns. If you like tales of high seas adventure, derring do, and also want to learn more about who Blackbeard supported to be king, you can learn more about all of that at the Pirate History Podcast.
Welcome, everyone, to the Most Notorious Podcast. I'm Eric Rivenis. Please, listener discretion advised on today's episode. There is some graphic material ahead. Serial killer stuff, you know. All right, so let's get to the interview. I'm thrilled to have Skip Hollandsworth as my guest today. He's an award-winning journalist, screenwriter, and executive editor of Texas Monthly Magazine. He's also the author of the critically acclaimed book, The Midnight Assassin, Panic, Scandal, and the Hunt for America's First Serial Killer. Thanks for taking some time to chat with me.
Absolutely, Eric.
I've got to ask you, where did you come across this story? And why hasn't it been written about in a book before?
Well, there's so many historical stories that slip through the cracks. And in Texas especially, which has a lot of big history. The Alamo, the cattle drives, Spindletop, oil, NASA, the Dallas Cowboys, on and on and on and on. And one day I was reading this book about Jack the Ripper because I'm a depraved human being and I love blood and gore. And I'm reading this. It's an old historical pamphlet that came out around the time of the killings in Whitechapel in the east in the end of London in 1888. And there's this line in this pamphlet that said, Scotland Yard investigators suspect that the killer came from a, quote, small city in Texas, quote, where a series of similar murders had occurred 3 years earlier. Well, for Texas Monthly Magazine, crime is sort of my wheelhouse, and I like to write crime stories. And I thought, what small city in Texas? What series of similar murders? And I had never heard of in such a thing. And this was like in 1998, and, you know, there was nothing to really Google, and there was no index for old newspapers. And I just sort of blindly called the Austin newspaper, or the Austin library, and I said, do you have any files on old serial killers? And they mentioned the series of killings that occurred in 1885 or 1886. And they said, we have a small file on it, but it's just one or two clippings about some women that had been murdered. So I live in Dallas, Texas, and I began to go down to Austin and sit in front of those microfilm machines, which every researcher knows about. All technology in libraries has changed except for microfilm machines. They're still the same old things where you pull out the microfilm, you put it on that serrated steel edge. You have to run it underneath the glass plate. You've got to get it in focus. And back then, you know, you had to use change to make copies of anything. And often half the time the copies would come out blurred. And I just began to read the Austin American Statesman starting in the year 1884. And I read these stories about how Austin had been this former cow town that was just a population of only 3,500 people after the end of the Civil War. But now in 1884, the population was 16,000, and it was hurtling into the Gilded Age of America from its sepia-toned Old West past. Electric lights were arriving. Party line telephones were arriving. Congress Avenue, which was the main boulevard of the city, was full of horse-drawn carriages, mule-driven streetcars, cowboys on horseback, and teenagers on what were called velocipedes back then, which are now known as bicycles. And stores were opening. A new state university was opening called the University of Texas that already had 392 students, and no one could believe there were that many students who would want to go to college in Texas. There was a new state lunatic asylum that had opened. The mayor, a real estate developer, kept walking up and down the wooden sidewalks of Congress Avenue saying Austin was headed for this golden new age. It was entering this golden new era. And it was completely fascinating to be able, by just going through the papers, to watch a city transform itself. In the words of one reporter, change as quickly as the turn of a kaleidoscope. And, you know, I was just building these files of information, printing out one story after another about stores opening that sold pianos, hats for women, flush toilets, hardwood carpets, which we know as linoleum floors. A new hotel was opening that was three stories high with flush toilets on the top floors, which had never been seen before in west of the Mississippi. The Driscoll Hotel, for any of you who still come to Austin. And I'm building up all this information, and I'm thinking, this is great, but where are the murders? Where are these murders I'm talking about? And on January 1st, 1885, I could have missed it because it was on page 3, toward the bottom of the page. And, you know, print back in 19th century newspapers back then was ridiculously small. There was a story that said, blood, blood, blood. And a servant woman named Molly Smith, a young servant woman who lived in a shack behind a wealthy white family's home, a woman who would get up in the morning and change the fires, start new fires, begin to cook, do the washing, carry out the bedpans, do all the work that's required, but painstaking, backbreaking work for $12 a week, was found in her backyard, dragged outside from her shed, her head split in two with an axe, dagger marks up and down her body, and she was laid out on her back with her arms out like a demented crucifixion scene or like a work of depraved art that some artist wanted everyone to see. Well, in January 1885, the term serial killer did not exist. There was no concept that some man would want to get out of his house, stalk a woman, murder her, massacre her, mutilate her body, and then leave her to be found while he made his escape. I mean, there had been no such person. It's hard for us to imagine this because our libraries are full of serial killer novels, but there had been no such person like that in America, even in fiction at that time. You know, in Edgar Allan Poe's Murders in the Rue Morgue, the short story, two women were found massacred and mutilated inside a locked hotel room in Paris. But the killer in that case turned out to be an orangutan, not a human being. So police, who had no criminology, there was no science of criminology. There were no fingerprint evidence. There was no blood evidence. There was no hair evidence. There was no blood typing. There was nothing. They had basically bloodhounds who would smell around the body and, you know, follow a scent, and whoever was at the end of the scent would get arrested. Well, the police turned the bloodhounds out around Molly Smith's body, but there was too much blood for the bloodhounds. They couldn't smell anything other than her blood because she was laying in a pool of her own blood. So the cops do exactly what cops you think have done for generations. They went out and arrested her ex-boyfriend, a young black male who worked as a bartender in a black saloon. And they said that he had murdered her because he was jealous of the fact that she had broken up with him and was dating someone else. And case closed. Even though he had a perfect alibi that night he was at a party on the east side of Austin and could not have possibly have gotten over to this other house where Molly Smith worked and lived. So the cops arrested her ex-boyfriend, a man named Lem Brooks, despite no evidence and a perfect alibi, and they threw him in the calaboose, which was then the term used for the city jail, and that was that. It was called a Negro murder. And then a few months later, it happened again. A young servant woman was found outside of her servant quarters in the back of a in the backyard of a prominent white family. Her head split in two, dagger marks up and down her body. And this time, an ice pick had been driven through her ear and pulled out, essentially lobotomizing her. Another ex-boyfriend was arrested, a young black male. Then came a third murder. Woman was basically, this time there was it was a little bit different. She was scalped like an Indian and dagger marks up and down her body, found in her backyard. And another black male was arrested. So the first woman was Molly Smith, then came Eliza Shelley, and then came Irene Cross. And it was still considered just a, as even the most intelligent white men said in the city, a Negro problem. Even though this was 25 years after the Civil War, the racism was significant and pervasive even among the upper class educated white Austinites. There was this theory that a lot of people still believed back then that because young black males had not experienced what one writer described as, quote, the civilizing benefit of slavery, then they had not been civilized, and they tended to, in the words of another writer, retrograde to their primordial state. So there was this theory that the killing of Molly Smith had set off a kind of bloodlust in other young black men to do the same kind of killings to their ex-girlfriends or women they didn't like. And so it started this kind of chain reaction. There was another theory that a union had come to town made up of black men trying to unionize the servant women so they could get higher pay, and any servant woman that didn't join the union was massacred. There was even a third theory that a kind of cloud of killing mania had floated over the black neighborhoods of Austin, driving men to kill women. And this was talked about among the best and brightest of Austin society, standing on the street corners of Congress Avenue. So there was another killing. After Irene Cross, after the third killing, a young mother was, you know, because many of the black servant women were terrified. They knew something was horribly the matter. They were not being heard. But one new servant woman had moved out of her servant quarters and moved into the kitchen and slept on the floor with her 12-year-old daughter.
And this was Rebecca Ramey.
Rebecca Ramey and her daughter Mary. The killer came in, sandbagged Rebecca and knocked her out, and then grabbed Mary and dragged her out into the backyard and into a kind of potting plant shed and drove an ice pick through her ear and left her there to die, which she did. And then came even another killing where there were three servant women who were so scared that they slept together in one little tiny servant's quarters with one of the women's boyfriends. And these were tiny little shacks. I mean, they were not bigger than one car garages. And someone came in, sandbagged or chloroformed three women and the boyfriend, knocked them over the head with a sandbag, and then dragged one of the servant women, a young woman named Gracie Vance, whose boyfriend was Orange Washington, who was sleeping with her, out to the backyard of a neighbor's home and beat her face in with a brick until her face looked like jelly, according to one reporter. It turned out that Orange had been hit so hard, the boyfriend, that he too died, but it was a kind of accidental killing. It was clear that whoever was doing that killing was after one of the young black women and who did this kind of ceremonial massacre of her. Well, there was all kinds of uproar. Private detectives were brought in from Houston. They made an arrest of a barefoot black chicken thief named Oliver Townsend because they said if he is smart enough to sneak into white people's chicken coops and cut off the heads of chicken and get away with it, then he's obviously doing the same thing to the black women of Austin. I mean, just a completely ridiculous notion. Those private detectives got fired. A new city marshal came in who basically did a form of ethnic cleansing. He'd had all the black men who had criminal records rounded up and taken to the edge of the city limit sign and told to leave. Or better yet, he stuck some of these criminals on a train and sent them unknown to San Antonio to get them out of Austin. He also got more police officers. He had more private watchmen. He had little watching the white neighborhoods. And for several months, nothing seemed to happen. And people thought they were safe. There was always this slightly lurking fear that maybe these black killers were going to turn their killing attacks on white women, but nothing happened. And on Christmas Eve, everything was totally peaceful. It was a warm, mild evening. There was a smell of cinnamon and wood smoke in the air. People were having parties at the new lunatic asylum. A man dressed up as Santa Claus and sang Christmas carols to the lunatics. That's what they were called back then. At the Deaf and Dumb Asylum in Austin, children stood up and did signed Christmas carols as the part of their concert. At a pharmacist party, the big rich pharmacist, he had someone sing Santa Claus is Coming Tonight, which was the new hit song in America. People were were buying Christmas trees, which was the tradition then. You bought them on Christmas Eve and decorated them that night. And around midnight, the new city marshal, Marshal James Lucy, was standing at the corner of Congress Avenue and 6th Street, and he heard the sound of hoofbeats racing up Congress Avenue from the south part of the city, which was where the Colorado River borders the city. And he shouted, "Marshal Lucy, come quick. Susan Hancock's been found in her backyard, her head chopped in two." Well, Susan Hancock was a 40-year-old white socialite, mother of two pretty teenage daughters. Lucy races down there. Other cops race down to the house. They race by a bunch of saloons who begin to hear the hoofbeats and hear about the noise that there's another killing. And a lot of the customers in the saloon had been drinking a brand new beer that had just come in from St. Louis that week called Budweiser for 10 cents a draw. And all these men suddenly descended on the Hancock home, staring at her body, obliterating the footprints that might have been around her body. The bloodhounds arrive, and they can't smell anything because they can just smell only blood. And the men are standing there trying not to panic. And then come the sound of more hoofbeats, this time from the northern end of Congress Avenue. And it was a police officer who raced down to the Hancock home. He said, "Marshal Lucy, you have to come with me. Young Eula Phillips has been found in her backyard, her head chopped to pieces." But Eula Phillips was the young socialite in Austin, also white, who was married to a young son of the leading architect in the city, Jimmy Phillips, whose father was James Phillips. They lived in the Phillips mansion, which had a big back wing where they lived with their young infant son. And Eula was found in her backyard, her head chopped in two, dagger marks up and down her body, her nightgown clenched up around her neck. Apparently, the killer had dragged her from her bedroom, holding her with her nightgown. And what was different about this killing was that pieces of kindling had been put on top of each of her breasts, and one's jammed into her vagina. It would look like, as I said, a demented crucifixion scene. And up Congress Avenue for about a mile raced this posse of cops, bloodhounds, the mayor, the district attorney, all the drunks from the saloons who had been drinking Budweiser. They raced up there, and they knew something awful was going on in their city that they couldn't understand. So this is Christmas Eve now, past midnight, and on these newfangled, high-tech party line telephones, the word began to spread. People picked up their telephones and heard the black demons are after the white women. Some men grabbed their families and put them in the corner of their houses and stood in front of them with a cocked shotgun, waiting for whoever was out there to come in and get them out there in the darkness. Other men had the bright idea, and there were a lot of them, of throwing their families in a wagon and riding, racing to Congress Avenue and 6th Street, where there were some gas lamps that were still flickering. You know, we forget how dark these cities were back in the late 19th century. There were no streetlights, porch lamps, nothing. And it was just pitch black except for this one street corner. And at 2 in the morning or 3 in the morning, a reporter for a Fort Worth newspaper raced to the Western Union telegram office and sent a telegram back to Fort Worth that said 3,000 Austin residents were huddled together under the gas lamps at 6th and Congress, waiting for whatever was out there to come after them. Some of the people there were holding pitchforks, old flintlocks from the Texas Revolution, pistols. Some were holding torches. It was such a cinematic scene that you think could only be invented in the movies. And here it was happening. And needless to say, Christmas was canceled that day. The church services were canceled. Presents were left unopened under the Christmas tree. Christmas dinners were not cooked. There was a giant meeting at the temporary state capitol. The new state capitol was getting built, and just to give you an idea of how big it was, the architects had ordered the new state capitol to be 11 feet taller than the U.S. Capitol, because the phrase back then, everything must be bigger in Texas, already existed. 700 city leaders, 700 white men, met at the new state capitol and tried to come up with answers about what to do. There was still the conviction that black men were behind all this. So one of the ideas was that every white man form a ring around the city hand in hand and walk forward one step at a time until they came across a black man with blood on his clothes. And then they would question him. And if he had no adequate explanation for why he had the blood on his clothes, then he could be lynched, hung up on the grounds of the new state capitol. And that almost passed. It was finally voted down, and there were vigilante committees that were agreed to work every neighborhood, men on horseback who had the right to question, interrogate, and perhaps lynch any black man they came across. It was that vicious of a solution. The mayor, sensing that that something else needed to be done, went to the Western Union office and telegrammed the famous Pinkerton agency in Chicago, the great detective agency, and said, I'll pay you $5,000 to come down here and help me find who the killers are. And they said, we're on our way. Ironically, and almost hilariously, the telegram got diverted not to the William and Alan Pinkerton's agency, the famous one, but to a man named Matthew Pinkerton, who had started his own detective agency just to take advantage of his last name, who knew nothing about detective work. So there was this general sense that everything, that the world had changed in Austin, and it had, and in many ways it had changed for the rest of America. This was the first serial killer, documented serial killer, who ritualistically murdered his victims and then, after a cooling off period, did it again.
When Johann Rahl received the letter on Christmas Day 1776, he put it away to read later. Maybe he thought it was a season's greeting and wanted to save it for the fireside. But what it actually was a warning, delivered to the Hessian colonel, letting him know that General George Washington was crossing the Delaware and would soon attack his forces. The next day, when Rahl lost the Battle of Trenton and died from two Colonial Boxing Day musket balls, the letter was found, unopened, in his vest pocket. As someone with 15,000 unread emails in his inbox, I feel like there's a lesson there. Oh well, this is The Constant, a history of getting things wrong. I'm Mark Chrysler. Every episode, we look at the bad ideas, mistakes, and accidents that misshaped our world. Find us at constantpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, box of oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies?
Well, of course you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
They've done weird things. Cat and Jethro, Box of Oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the Box of Oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
All you need is a few minutes to start your day off with something historic when you listen to the This Day in History podcast. Every day, there's a new episode for you to listen and learn about what happened that day way back when. Today could be the day a famous mobster met their end, or the first milestone for humans in space. Who knows what history today holds? Find out when you listen and subscribe to This Day in History wherever you get your podcasts. That's This Day in History wherever you get your podcasts.
The storm broke in Chattanooga one night in 1906 when a young woman was the victim of a violent crime. From that moment, the city knew no peace for four furious years. At the center of the storm was the notorious inmate Dave Edwards, who was awaiting trial on murder charges. After a high-profile case threatened to go cold, the desperate county sheriff did the unthinkable by freeing Dave Edwards from jail and deputizing him to track down the fugitive. Grievous Deeds, 4 Years of Fury in Chattanooga, Tennessee, written by Kimberly Tilly, narrated by Samuel Burst, is the most amazing true crime story you've never heard. Listen to Grievous Deeds, the audiobook, available on Audible, iTunes, and Amazon.
I'd like to establish a timeline here, just so listeners understand how far apart these murders were from each other. So the first murder happened on December 31st, 1884, to Molly Smith. Then Eliza Shelley was next a few months later on May 6th, 1885. Then Irene Cross was killed on the night of May 22nd. The horrible murder of the little girl, Mary Ramey, and her mom happened on August 30th of 1885. Gracie Vance and Orange Washington were murdered on September 28th of that year. And then there is a lull until Christmas of 1885 when Susan Hancock and Eula Phillips were killed. Basically, one full year after the first murder.
Yeah, the killings took place almost exactly in a period of one calendar year, starting on December 31st, 1884, and ending on Christmas Eve, 1885.
One of the things that struck me while reading your book was just the general incompetency of the police department. Was it pure incompetence? They were certainly ill-equipped to deal with a killer of this nature.
They were certainly incompetent. They were high school educated brutes, essentially. I mean, they were enforcers. They were like bouncers at bars. You know, they just sort of grabbed criminals who had done things and dragged them off to the calaboose. They had to be tough and strong more than smart. But they were ignorant, not necessarily, it wasn't necessarily their fault they were so ignorant. I mean, there was no criminology for them to use, and they just simply had no way of conceiving the idea that one man was behind it.
Yeah, there was no precedent for this at all.
There was no precedent. Even the smartest young man in town, a young writer named William Sidney Porter, who later moved to New York and changed his name to O. Henry and became the greatest short story writer of the late 19th century, he didn't get it. He wrote a letter to his friend that said Austin was being plagued by servant girl annihilators. But the panic in the after the post-Christmas Eve murders was such that people began to start wondering if maybe it was the act of one man. Now, they immediately latched onto the idea that it was a lunatic who escaped from the lunatic asylum, who had probably been affected by the light of the moon. Back then, there was this theory that if you were under too much moonlight, you could go crazy. The word lunatic comes from Latin luna, moon, and that he turned into a kind of werewolf overnight under the moonlight and did his killings. And then when the sun came up, he was fine again. And there were lots of people who believed that. There were lots of people who believed the kind of Frankenstein from the Mary Shelley novel was on the loose in Austin and hiding underneath the city in the tunnels. There was even a belief that a crazed old Indian who had escaped from the reservation up in Oklahoma had come down to Austin to do one last act of terror. Then a reporter came down from New York City, and he worked for the New York World, which was the newspaper owned by the famous and legendary Joseph Pulitzer, the great newspaper publisher of the late 19th century. Pulitzer had an eye for news, and he had a nose for what people would read, and he realized that people were going to read about this murder mystery going on in Texas. And the reporter wrote a 7,000-word story, almost as long as the obituary for Ulysses Grant earlier that year in the World, in which he said that maybe what's happening here is not a lunatic on the loose. It's not a black man. It's not a gang of black men. It's not someone affected by the light of the moon. It's a very smart white man who plots out his murders, plots out his escapes, and is strong enough to carry them off and intelligent enough to avoid detection. And he wrote that there has never been a killer like this before in American society. It was a very prescient story that he wrote. He described the killer as the, quote, intangible nemesis. But another San Antonio reporter who picked up on his story and wrote another piece saying that maybe there was a white man doing all the killings called him the Midnight Assassin. And that's the name that stuck around Austin, that maybe the city was plagued by a midnight assassin. And the city leaders, the bankers, the politicians, and the leaders of the state government realized that Austin, which was on the verge of this golden new era as the great city of Texas and of the Southwest, its reputation about to be destroyed and people were moving out and, you know, this kind of craziness was going to plague Austin forever. They said, we have got to find the killers. And this is when the case just turns even more bizarre. And I, you know, I'm going through the newspapers over and over, and I'm thinking, this is amazing, but surely something happens next. And what happens next was they arrested the husbands, of the white husbands of Susan Hancock, the first white victim on Christmas Eve, and the husband of Eulah Phillips, the second white victim on Christmas Eve. And they said that these two men hated their wives, beat their wives, were drunkards who beat their wives, and came up coincidentally with the same plan to knock off their wives on Christmas Eve and make it look like the black killers had done it. And both men were arrested and thrown in the calaboose. Well, that set off an uproar because half the town believed it and half the town thought this is madness, this is craziness. No one would ever come up with this kind of solution. Well, then as there's all this chaos and arguments on the streets and debates about whether the two white husbands were copycats, essentially, the fake Pinkertons announced that they had come to the end of their investigation and they had discovered the killer of at least one of the victims. And his name, they said, was William Swain. Well, William Swain is unknown to history, but at the time he was the most popular politician in Texas. He was the comptroller of the state government. He was this financial genius and he was big as an old oak wardrobe. He was running for governor for 1886 and was considered a shoe-in because no other candidate could touch him. But then the fake Pinkertons announced that they had received a telegram from a prominent, anonymously, from a prominent Austin citizen that said Swain had been seen with Eulah Phillips on Christmas Eve at a, quote, house of assignation, which was then a phrase used to describe a boarding house where the owner of the boarding house kept a couple of rooms in the back always open for wealthy men to carry on their affairs with prostitutes or their mistresses. And according to the telegram, Swain on Christmas Eve had met Eulah Phillips at the house of assignation. Well, there was now even another uproar that Swain was the killer, that Swain at least was identified with one of the victims. And Swain himself had to hold his own press conference where he stood up in front of his desk and said to the assembled reporters that he had never had sex with that young woman and that he didn't even know her. But political rumors being political rumors, the rumor stuck. And it turned out that the source of the rumor was the campaign manager for Saul Roth, Swain's opponent, and the campaign manager had basically tarred William Swain by calling him the Midnight Assassin. Saul Ross wins the election. Swain is ruined politically. He moves out of Austin. And it's the first time, and certainly maybe the only time in American history, when a top politician has been ruined by being tainted with the brush of a political dirty trick, that he was a serial killer.
It's such a crazy, insane story.
You know, you're right. I'm sitting there thinking, it's really strange, my reaction, because I was going through the newspapers. I said, there's got to be some way to wrap this up. Surely there's got to be some piece of evidence that indicates who the killer is. And when I came, and there's got to be some relief to this story. There's got to be something funny that happens in this story, because it is so dark and so violent and so horrific. And then when I came across this scandal with the fake Pinkertons and William Swain, I just sort of lifted my head from the microfilm machine and went, thank you, God. It was just a perfect kind of comic relief for the third act. Nevertheless, as 1886 continued to go on, there was no answer as to who did it. There was the trials of the two husbands took place. One ended in a mistrial. The other was reversed. The other one was convicted but reversed on appeal. So there was no answer on that. There were rumors that got started about a young doctor who worked at the insane asylum right after the Christmas Eve murders. He was institutionalized in his own asylum for mental illness, and he had gone mentally crazy, and then he was moved to even another asylum where he mysteriously died. And there was, you know, my thinking was there was a giant cover-up involving him, that maybe he was the killer, and there was a cover-up involving him. You know, maybe people came back around to thinking maybe it was the chicken thief, Oliver Townsend, the barefoot black chicken thief. There were just numerous killing suspects bouncing around the city, and it just kept getting more and more disturbing because there was clearly no answer.
Can you talk about Nathan Elgin? He appears in your story as a suspect at the Hancock trial. What was his connection to the case?
Well, then even another theory was that a young black male named Nathan Elgin, who had four toes on his foot, and who had been shot by a sheriff's deputy after a bar fight in a black saloon right after the Christmas Eve killings. The rumor was that he was the killer, because one of the footprints around one of the bodies seemed to show a four-toed foot. And so maybe that was Nathan Elgin's, was everybody's thinking. And now that he was dead, the killings had come to a stop. Well, the testimony in the trial showed that it wasn't a four-toed foot. It was just a footprint of a very light impression. So there was no real evidence to tie him to the murders. But see, here's the thing, Eric. Because there's so little evidence, because there's no police reports available, they've all been destroyed, there's no way of telling what was really known. So any suspect likely to have done it could be thrown up on the canvas and his name sticks. Because you can't really rule someone out, there's all sorts of people who possibly could have done the killings.
Oh, of course. I mean, there were a lot of suspects. I wanted to go back to one piece of evidence you point out in your book, that police reported barefoot tracks around the scenes of the murders. The person who was doing this often seemed to be shoeless, right?
Well, he might not have been wearing shoes when he sneaked up on the servant quarters, but he clearly either put them on and ran away after the killings, or he ran toward a horse or a carriage and jumped in and changed his clothes in the carriage and put on shoes or boots. The footprints are a mystery because there was never enough to determine whether it was the same footprint at every crime scene, because so many of the footprints were obliterated by people walking up to stare at the body in their own boots.
What were the commonalities amongst all of the murders? Would you mind briefly summarizing those for us?
Well, the murders seemed to have a similarity in the fact that an axe was used There was knife marks. Some of the victims had the ice pick slammed into their ear and pulled out. But there were also little differences. One of the victims was wrapped in blankets when she was found. Another victim was scalped. Another victim was the face with a brick. So the killers seemed to experiment a little bit with each victim, changing his mode just a little, if it was the same killer. I mean, if there were different killers working, if the original theory among Austin's white leaders was true, that this was a group of black men who were doing it, then that makes sense too. You can't rule it out.
I know you've already pointed it out, but it's just so odd that the first two victims were killed on the same night and not far apart in location or time of death. And these two husbands both put on trial for killing their wives within minutes of each other. I mean, it was either a conspiracy or just complete hogwash.
It was a conspiracy, it was complete hogwash, or because we don't know for sure, it's possible. It's a tiny possibility, but it's possible that these two men did in fact come up with the idea of killing their wives on Christmas Eve and making it look like the black killers had done it. They were the first copycats in American serial killing history. It just sounds ridiculous, of course. But the problem, you know, that I've learned, because I do journalism, and there's always cops to interview, there's witnesses to interview, there's medical examiners to interview, there's public records to look at. In this case, there was just nothing to rule people out except logic. And the problem with writing a historical book, as I've learned, is not necessarily how much you've got that's the problem, but what you obsess about are the things you don't know. You know, did William Swain really have this affair with Eula Phillips, William Swain the politician? Did he meet her on Christmas Eve? If so, why didn't he kill her? If maybe he was being caught by someone, saw them together, and he knew that she couldn't tell, or, you know, there was some reason that he felt he had to kill her so that he would not be revealed as being her paramour and thus lose the election that way.
Could there have been some connection between Susan Hancock and Eula Phillips? Maybe Susan Hancock saw something she shouldn't have that night and was murdered for it.
Correct. You know, maybe he was on his way to Eula Phillips and was riding by the house of Susan Hancock's, and she saw him. And so he double backed and killed her and then moved on to Eula Phillips. You know, the other mystery is why he picked the women he did. And that's tormented researchers. There's a lot of people that research this case, and they're like the Jack the Ripper researchers, who are men and women who spend their lives in the London libraries. And it's like the JFK researchers in Dallas. Just the gaps, the holes, the lack of convincing information is what drives you. And, you know, I was convinced for at least a couple years researching this book that I was going to figure out who the killer was. I mean, Austin was only 15,000 to 17,000 people. Surely someone knew who the killer was, who was slipping out of his house at night. There surely had to be some letter, some scrap from a diary, some newspaper article that no one had ever before seen that would suggest who the killer was. And I, in my narcissistic manner, was convinced I was going to find it and solve this great crime story. But this story is our American Jack the Ripper. It's what haunts us is what we don't know and what we will perhaps never know.
This was something that was really striking to me while I was reading your book. I mean, there was plenty of panic amongst the white community as these murders were happening, but the black community was even more frightened as African-American women were the ones being targeted for most of the period these murders were happening. And they weren't sticking around either. They were fleeing Austin in such great numbers that the whites were afraid that their primary source of labor was in jeopardy.
A lot of women left town. Galveston, the city of Galveston, put ads in the Austin paper inviting servant women to come to Galveston where life was better and they could get work and they could stay safe. Even the dusty, horrendous border town of Laredo took out ads in the Austin paper inviting people to move to Laredo, which was crime-free, the streets of Laredo, which was sort of hilarious. There was, you know, old African-American residents were convinced that Austin was being plagued by a kind of evil spirit. These are people who were still superstitious and thought that someone with an evil eye had come to Austin to attack their women and wreak havoc. And essentially they were describing a serial killer.
So the Austin killings stopped after Susan Hancock and Eula Phillips. What is your theory on not only why they stopped in Austin, but what the reason might have been for similar murders suddenly being committed in surrounding Texas towns?
After the Christmas Eve killings, there was a killing a few days later, an axe killing of a servant woman in San Antonio. And immediately the black boyfriend was blamed. About a year later, there was a double killing of two young white teenagers who were spending the night together in the North Texas town of Gainesville, several hours horseback ride away from Austin. And they were murdered exactly the way, you know, axed in the head and stabbed with daggers, with knives, exactly in the way that it looked like the Austin killings were done. There was then other killings around America, one in Cleveland, where a woman would be killed with an axe, and immediately the thinking was the midnight assassin had moved there. And then in 1888, of course, came the theory that the midnight assassin had moved to Austin to become Jack the Ripper. It was a theory so well believed that the leading alienist in America, Edward Spitzka, a man with a little pointy beard and monocle over his glasses, stood in front of the New York Academy of Medicine at Bryant Park in New York City and gave this thunderous speech that was received with a standing ovation that Jack the Ripper had definitely done his training in Texas. Newspapers picked up the story, both in the United States and England. In the United States, everyone said it made sense that the killer could have gone to London. The London newspapers also pushed the story because it made a lot more sense that an uncouth Texan had come to their beautiful country to do these killings and not one of their own would have done it. So it was all PR. It was all marketing. And Austin leaders were thrilled for people to believe that Jack the Ripper came from Austin, because that meant the Midnight Assassin was no longer in their country, but overseas across the pond.
So what do you think about this? I mean, it's interesting. I did a podcast with a guest who shot down the idea of H.H. Holmes actually being Jack the Ripper. There's so many people who want to believe that Jack the Ripper was an American. Like you said, some British people were then, maybe even now, eager to shift the blame over to us. And frankly, we've got television shows encouraging this being produced now, and Americans seem almost excited to accept the blame. I mean, what's going on?
Well, that's been a long-term theme among Jack the Ripper researchers. And novelists have always had, you know, Jack the Ripper coming from America, or Jack the Ripper going to America and doing killings in San Francisco and so on. You know, you can't dismiss it because there's no evidence to prove the negative. At one point, there was a story in the newspapers that a Malaysian man who worked as a cook at an Austin restaurant had left Austin right after the Christmas Eve murders, gone to Galveston, jumped on a steamer, and gone to England, where he was going to work as a cook in England. So the theory began that Malaysian cook had done the killings in Austin and had gone to London and had become Jack the Ripper. Scotland Yard was so convinced that it was true, or just did not want to ignore the rumor, that it rounded up all the Malaysians it could find in London and interrogated them to see if they might be Jack the Ripper. The story of the Malaysian cook went nowhere. Scotland Yard's own ethnic cleansing of the Malaysian cooks just turned into an embarrassment. But it proved the hysteria that was going on, that no one had any idea in Austin or 3 years later in London how to find a serial killer.
And the actual murders are very dissimilar, right? I mean, Jack the Ripper wasn't actually hatcheting people in their skulls or shoving ice picks through their ears.
They're very dissimilar, and there was no ice pick. And the Jack the Ripper killer cut open the abdomens of his victims and took away organs, which did not happen in Austin, nor were there axe attacks on the victims in London. The axe attacks only occurred on the victims in Austin. But the fact was that there were so few killings like this, so brutal murders, that the way the alienists explained it, the famous Dr. Spitzka, was that Jack the Ripper had improved his technique from what he did in Austin. He was more brutal in Austin and more careless, and now he was more refined, like a surgeon working his victims in London.
It's an interesting theory of an escalation, although the example you give about the Malaysian cook, I mean, how he could suddenly have surgical skills is a little goofy.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the question of Jack the Ripper is one of the great international mysteries. Well, let me put it this way. Jack the Ripper was on the front page of every newspaper in the world. That story became one of the great murder mysteries of all time and still is to this day. The Midnight Assassin story, because it happened in this tiny little Texas city far away from most of the major cities of America, never got media traction the way Jack the Ripper did. Yet both stories are essentially the same mysteries. Out of nowhere, someone began doing these killings of women, these ritualistic mutilations and murders of women, and were able to get away, and by police incompetence or ignorance, were able to return and do another killing again. You know, I am sure there were other killers who were drifters, who would kill somebody in one town and then move to another town, and because there was no communications between the towns, no one knew that there had been a killing in the first town that looked exactly like the killing in the second town. But there was very few, if any, killings where the killer stayed in the same city and worked his killings month after month after month.
I'm wondering about the Eula Phillips murder, the last one in Austin. You mentioned that her body had been treated differently than the others. Wood stacked atop her body, piece of wood inserted in her vagina. The Eula Phillips murder is different than the others in this regard. It's more sexual in nature than the others.
There's no way of definitely knowing whether the women had been raped, except if you found semen samples inside them. You could at least know that they had recently had sex. But even then, the autopsies were not refined, and they were easy to miss, and we're not sure that the autopsies were even conducted of all the victims. But with the Eula Phillips case, the last victim murdered, there did seem like to be a kind of strange sexual element to it that wasn't like in the other murders, where the kindling was put on top of her breast and inside her vagina. What that means, no one has been able to determine, and you can only guess. But clearly the killer was using these murders as some sort of sexual substitute.
So this has been really great. I'll bet there are people listening interested in checking this out a little further on their own. Where can they find more about you and The Midnight Assassin and your book?
Well, you can get the book at themidnightassassin.com or off of Amazon. And there's lots and lots of information in the book that we barely touched in our interesting conversation. And there's a giant bibliography. And there's plenty of room for people to do research on their own. I'm still waiting for someone to read the book and think, you know, there's a document up in my attic, a letter from my great-grandmother that tells me something about these killings. But the book's now been out for 2 years, and I'm still waiting for that phone call to come in. But I'm still waiting. I'm still full of hope.
So I've got one final question for you, and I know it's a loaded one since you've already told me you have no idea who did it, but with all the suspects you present, is there one you personally lean towards as the Midnight Assassin?
Well, I lean towards the doctor. My sister, but I just had no absolute evidence that would even suggest he was considered a suspect. But my sister, who's a doctor, said, Skip, you're such a dummy. The killer had to be a doctor because he would only be able to have that kind of pen that could drive, that could go through someone's ear. And clearly other people that were in the rooms had to be chloroformed, and only a doctor had access to the chloroform. And the fact that this young doctor at the lunatic asylum, who treated lunacy all day long, gets institutionalized in his own asylum for his own brand of lunacy in this mysterious court hearing that gets him institutionalized for an indefinite period of time, and then he mysteriously dies within months, so he cannot tell his story, or so a story cannot come out about him, just seems really suspicious. And I point this out at length in the book, but again, I can't point the finger at him because there's still that one missing piece of evidence that would link him.
Fascinating. What was that doctor's name again?
It's Dr. James Givens. He was the assistant superintendent of the state lunatic asylum, and his father ran the his father-in-law ran the asylum. And so one of my theories was the father-in-law did not want his famous asylum, which was being written about in national publications, to be tainted, the reputation tainted by the news coming out that his own son-in-law had done these killings. Because he was trying at the asylum to do all these new kind of techniques to make insane people sane, that he had him put away. But that's a big stretch to come up with if you don't have a single bit of documents to prove it.
This would make a great television series.
Well, any producer out there that's listening, give me a call. I'm happy to talk to you.
Well, super. I hope you get some calls. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks so much, Eric. I enjoyed it.
Again, my guest has been Skip Hollandsworth, author of The Midnight Assassin, Panic, Scandal, and the Hunt for America's First Serial Killer. Also, don't forget to subscribe to the new Mafia podcast. Highly recommended. This has been another episode of the Most Notorious podcast, broadcasting to every dark and cobwebbed corner of the world. I'm Eric Rivenis, and have a safe tomorrow.
My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a historian, professor, and the creator of History That Doesn't Suck, a podcast that provides a complete overview of U.S. history through storytelling, yet keeps the rigor you'd expect in a university class. Starting with 22-year-old George Washington in his first battle, join me for a chronological telling of the United States' story, its unlikely revolution, fractious civil war, tenacious inventors, brave reformers, and more. With more than 100 episodes, you can already binge listen your way through the progressive era. Find History That Doesn't Suck wherever you get your podcasts.